Take up our Old Testament here this morning and turn to the 12th chapter of Deuteronomy as we continue our survey of Moses' fifth book, his final book, before he would pass from the scene of leadership, and that leadership would be ultimately passed down to Joshua. And so let us always remember that as we read Deuteronomy, in reference to time, we're looking at 40 years after the Exodus. All right? 40 years. Secondly, he is speaking to a second generation of Israelites that were born, nurtured, and toughened up, if you will, by 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, trusting God not only for food and drink, but they would not be succumbed by any marauding army or armies at that time. Their sandals never wore out. Their clothes did not need to be changed. He led them by the cloud by day and the fiery pillar at night. And yet during those 40 years, they chided not only with God, but with Moses. Moses was also chided by family members as well, his brother and his sister. But now he's coming to the end of his calling. And before the nation is going to be moving along a parallel on the east side of the Jordan River, going through such tribes as Ammon, Moab and such, being treated poorly and harshly, learning to fight and trust God, he gives them these words. And so with that in mind, look at verse 1. I'm going to read down to verses 12 here this morning. A lesson entitled, God, the God, who directs and dictates. These are the statutes and judgments which ye shall observe to do in the land, which the Lord God of thy fathers giveth thee to possess it, all the days that you live upon the earth. Well, that sounds as very matter of fact. God was going to give them the land. And as you read the book of Joshua, you will see that promise as it related to the land being fulfilled in the closing chapters of the book of Joshua. The idea that the Israelites never achieved the fullness of the boundaries of that promised land, to say that that was never fulfilled and has to be yet fulfilled, is very dangerous and not honest with the scriptures. Verses 1 here is quite plain. The land which the Lord of thy fathers giveth thee to possess it. Not a hope so, not a maybe so, but it sounds very matter of fact. Ye shall surely destroy all the places wherein the nations which ye shall possess serve their gods, upon the high mountains and upon the hills and under every green tree. So notice, when they were to go into the land and when they began to conquer these nations, they were to literally eradicate all the physical representations and all the places where these pagans worshipped their false gods. So notice how God here is directing and dictating his worship by his people once they get established in the land. And ye shall overthrow their altars and break their pillars, burn their groves with fire, and ye shall hew down the graven images of their gods and destroy the names of them out of that place. Well, there seems to be a sweeping cleaning up of the land, verses 2 and 3 so far. If you follow the words here, we see God directing and dictating what his people were to do, his covenant people, his covenant blood-bought, redeemed people, were to do when they possessed the land. They were not to assimilate, and they were not to mix or blend the worship of God with the pagan worship of the people who were now occupying the land. They were not even to use the places and the groves and the high places where the pagans once worshipped their pagan gods. Ye shall not do so unto the Lord your God. So notice in verses 4, this is God directing to his people how they were to respond to him. Notice, ye shall not do so unto the Lord your God, but unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all of your tribes to put his name there, even unto his, notice, habitation shall ye seek, and thither thou shalt come. So if you look at verses 5, what is God here prophesying? What is God hinting at that would eventually become a fulfillment? Well, the very location, the very spot, and the very ultimate construction of the first temple that would be built in the days of Solomon. That was going to be the designated place. That would be the designated location where God's worship was to be performed. So notice again in verses 5, the God who directs and the God who dictates his worship by his people. We are not left to our own devices. God doesn't say, well, you come to me any way you want to, whenever you feel like it, and you can bring anything that the world has out there and put it in a blender, and then you add me to the mix and we'll see what comes out at the end. No, beloved, God dictates. Thither ye shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and heave offerings of your hand and your vows and your free willing offerings and the firstlings of your herds and of your flocks. And there, underline, there shall ye eat before the Lord your God. And ye shall rejoice in all that ye put your hand unto, ye and your households, wherein the Lord thy God hath blessed thee. So notice in verses 7 that the worship of God, yes, can be a private matter between you and your God. But God here is also dictating that there's going to be set times when the corporate people were to assemble, where they were to leave their respective homes, if you will, and go to a designated location and to reassemble as one body for the worship of God. So on that vein, allow me to make a modern-day New Testament application. If someone claims to be a Christian, they claim to love God, they claim that Jesus has saved them, but they divorce themselves from a New Testament Bible-believing congregation where you have a church that abides by the dictates that God has laid down, following a New Testament pattern of apostolic teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread and in prayers, observing baptism for those who believe, and the observance of the Lord's Supper on a regular basis, preaching the unadulterated gospel of God, living as a family community, loving one another, forbearing one another, tolerating one another, and advancing the kingdom of God, that's where you need to put your stake. This idea of Christians simply being home and worshiping God, either in the privacy of their study or out there on some lake under a tree, basking in the shade, is unscriptural. A child of God needs to be in a Bible-believing, gospel-preaching church, following the dictates that God has laid down. Notice verses 7. It talks about what? Your household. So verses 7 here has the implication of a gathering of God's people, whether it was under the old economy or whether it's under the present new economy, under the new covenant. Hebrews 10:25. Okay? And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembly of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as ye see the day approaching. What does the writer of Hebrews say? There were some, even in the first century, who were abandoning a consistent gathering with God's people, as the manner of some is, not was, but is. So when the writer of Hebrews penned that particular portion of that letter, there were those, even in the middle of the first century, who were getting very lazy, very apathetic when it came to their church membership and the attendance to God. Continue. Ye shall not do after all the things that we do here this day, every man whatsoever is right in your own eyes. I want you to look at that verse 8. Because many people read that verse 8 and they don't get the drift of what it's saying. Once again, they're on the east bank of the Jordan. They've just completed 40 years of wandering. Moses is about to pass off the scene. Leadership is going to be given to Joshua. Let me read it again to you. Ye shall not do after all the things that we do here this day. And notice what's being implied. Every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. So verses 8, I think, is implying that during the 40 years of wandering, that was like a transitional period from the Exodus, but not yet stepping foot into the promised land. And during the 40 years of wandering, okay, you had that tabernacle complex, that prefabricated place of worship that could be packaged, hauled off by the Levites, then unpacked and reassembled. And when you're wandering, okay, when you're wandering on ground that is not yours, and you're in this flux, you're in this intermediate state, certain things were allowed, certain exceptions were granted. But here, verses 8, I think, is implying, now that we're about to get into the land, or you are going to get into the land, we're no longer going to do things like we've been doing for 40 years. So notice that God now is transitioning this whole nation from a 40-year wandering, wherever they walked would not be theirs, to eventually crossing into the Jordan, and wherever their foot was placed on the ground, that would be where they would drive their stakes, if you will, and it would become theirs. And therefore, a new transition would now take place. For ye are not as yet come to the rest and to the inheritance which the Lord your God giveth you. See how verses 8 and 9, I think, is explaining? You've been in the desert. You've been wandering for 40 years. We did it one way. But now, we're about to go into the land. And God is going to redirect and redictate how things are going to be in the land of your possession. But when ye go over Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God giveth you to inherit, and when he giveth you rest from all your enemies round about, that sounds like a foregone conclusion to me. That sounds like something that God says you're going to get into the land and you're going to conquer it, so that you dwell safely. Then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. Thither shall ye bring all that I command you, all that I dictate, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, your heave offerings of your hand, and all your choice vows which ye vow unto the Lord. So look at verses 8, 9, 10, and 11. God is enumerating. I think he's providing the commentary when he says, we're no longer going to do things the way we've been doing for the past 40 years. Everyone doing, notice, whatever was right in his own eyes. Once we get into the land, the commandments and the statutes and the judgments and the laws that I've given to you will now fall into place. And my rulership over you as a people, safely established within the borders of your land, would then be enacted. I hope you can follow and see them. And then finally, verse 12. And ye shall rejoice, notice this, before the Lord your God. Now, in a few moments ago, we read Psalm 54, right? As our responsive read. And we noticed that David's oppressors did not walk with God before them. But notice here, you shall rejoice before the Lord your God. Ye and your sons and your daughters and your men servants and your maid servants and the Levite that is within your gates, for as much as he had no part nor inheritance with you. Notice once again, verse 12, you see not individual private worship, but you see worship conducted by what? The whole community. So once again, those who call themselves Christians today, and they don't get involved in a local church family, they don't go out of their way to find one, or maybe in the providence of God, establish one as a church plant endeavor. They're not in the will of God. God has never advocated private worship. Even under the age of the patriarchs, it was the father or the head male member of that clan officiating the worship of God, not as a lone ranger, but within the confines of his family, large extended families, like Job, for instance, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Noah, even the patriarchs that came prior to the flood. Well, that's introduction. We begin now, chapter 12, with a presupposition. I'm going to lay down a presupposition that's going to dictate our understanding of chapter 12. And here it is. God is God, and he alone dictates and directs as he pleases. I don't see too much in the first 12 verses here where God is giving the Israelites freedom to do what they feel like doing. Look at that verse 8. Ye shall not do after all the things that we do here, presently, this day. And then he enumerates every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. Okay, we see a transition about to occur. Well, let's turn to Exodus chapter 20 this morning. Exodus chapter 20. And let's consider the first 7 verses on this idea that God directs and that God has the right to dictate. I'm going to read just the first 7 verses because these are the first 3 of the 4 commandments out of the 10 commandments that relate to God. And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God. Notice the I am. The I am in the burning bush. Okay. The I am who Joshua saw in Joshua 5 with a sword drawn. I am the captain of the Lord's host. Then we have the one coming in the New Testament saying what? I am the bread of life. I am the way. I am the truth. Right? I am the good shepherd. I am the good physician, right? I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods, notice, before me. In Psalm 54, David's oppressors did not have God before them. But we just got done reading Deuteronomy 12, that when they get into the land, they were to rejoice, what? Before the Lord. Here, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I am the Lord, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. And since God is a jealous God, and that's even his name, or one of his names, my name is jealous, therefore he has the right to dictate and to direct how men, women, boys, and girls are to approach him. How are we to come, what? Before him. visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Notice next, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in a vain way, an empty way, a useless way, a crass way. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. So notice how this begins in verse 2. I am the Lord thy God, period. No other gods before me, period. I am a God who is jealous, period. I am a God who directs and dictates what you are to do. And when it comes to your worship, how you are to rejoice before me. Deuteronomy 12. Well, turn to Isaiah chapter 44. Isaiah chapter 44. Now, what was Moses, what was God telling Moses to tell the people in Deuteronomy 12? Well, when you get in the land, I want you to eradicate. I want you to destroy. I want you to tear down the pagan places of worship, which includes the high places, like on the top of hills or mountains, the groves, okay, an outcropping of trees or whatever, where there would be an altar, some type of a little cove. You were to break down their what? Altars. And you were to destroy their idols. Why? Why can't Israel just kind of come alongside and just blend paganism with the worship of the one true God? Now, that's going on today, even in Christian circles. Those who quote-unquote call themselves Christians, and those who would even have the word church or fellowship hall outside on their marquee. Today, in the 21st century, a lot of what's called Christianity is nothing more but Christianity blended with the entertainment and the stupidity of the world. But here God says no. You are to eradicate all places of worship, tear down their idols, tear down their altars. There's to be no assimilation. I must rule alone. And you are to rejoice, what? Before me. Not before me and maybe a couple of idols off to the side. Me and me alone. Well, look at Isaiah 44, verses 6 and 8. Thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts. So there we see God the Father and God the Son mentioned. I am the first, I am the last, and besides me there is no God. Notice verses 6. I am the first and the last. Well, guess what? The person whom John turns around and beholds in Revelation 1 says the same words. I am the last and the first. I am the Alpha and Omega. I was he who was dead but is alive forevermore. The words of Jesus in Revelation 1 are found here in Isaiah 44, 6. And so those who claim that Jesus is not God really haven't read their Bibles. Or maybe they have chosen not to see that connection between such words in verses 6 with the words that came forth out of the glorified, resurrected, ascended King. Look at verse 8. Fear ye not, neither be afraid. Have not I told thee from that time and have declared it? Ye are even my witnesses. So notice, the people of God were to be a witness. Is there a God beside me? Yea, there is no God. I know not any. So here God makes the declaration. I am God. There is no other God besides me. Therefore, follow my thought. I dictate. I direct my worship. I dictate those things, not you. I lay down the boundaries. Where I give you some latitude, there it is. But where there's no latitude, my word stands. If you're going to come and rejoice before me, it is to be done the way I dictate, because I am jealous. I am who I am. Turn to Isaiah 45, the next chapter. Look at verses 21 to 22. Isaiah 45, verses 21 to 22. Tell ye, and bring them near. Yea, let them take counsel together. Who hath declared this from ancient time? Who hath told it from that time? Have not I the Lord? And there is no God else beside me. A just God and a Savior, there is none beside me. Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God, and there is none else. So since he's God, since he's the Creator, since he's been here from all eternity, beloved, he runs the show. He doesn't share that with anyone. No Pope, no group of Bible professors, not a group of translators, not even the pastors, or elders, or bishops, Sunday school teachers, or deacons. He stands and he rules solitarily, because he is who he is. So here we see that there's to be no other gods before him, no competitors, no equals, no others, no rivals, none above him, none before him. Everything beneath him. We'll go back to Exodus chapter 20 in verses 4 once again. Exodus 20, look at verses 4. Exodus 20, verse 4. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the heaven, that's in the water under the earth. So whether it be something in the sky, like sun, moon, stars, whether it be something on the earth, like bugs, trees, or under the water, anything that swims, crawls, whatever. We don't make God into a lobster. We don't make him into a big whale. We don't make him into some leviathan. Not even a graven image. Not even an idol. Not even, now get this, a fictitious representation of God that we create even in our minds. Thus, there's no comparison. There's no redirected worship. And no wild imaginations. So sometimes when we look at paintings, and I love to see paintings, and there are myriads of paintings of Christian scenes depicted. And they depict God as an old, white-haired, white-bearded man. The Ancient of Days, a kind of a grandfatherly look. Or they have Jesus walking around with a halo or rays of light beaming out of his head. And there's all different types of facial representations of Jesus. Beloved, no one was there with a camera or with a movie projector making a film of the Jesus who once walked on this earth. We know that man is made to worship. Man is a creature who is religiously wound up to worship the true and living God. But when man fell in his depravity, that worship has been redirected. Romans chapter 1. When they ought to be worshiping the Creator, what does Paul tell us in Romans 1? They devolved, de-evolution, if you will, they devolved into worshiping what? The creature. Until eventually things that would crawl on the ground, they went from worshiping man, notice how it goes down, not up, man, full-footed beasts, fowls of the air, and then what? The base things, creeping things that crawl on the ground. So we see that man is not evolving from molecules to man to Superman. He's actually devolving from his high, lofty position, as you read in Psalm 8, just a little lower than the angels. And now, by virtue of his actions before God and his perverted worship of God, he's now become a brute, bloodthirsty, bloodshedding beast by his own nature. Exodus chapter again, verses 20, verse 4. No graven images, no idols, no fictitious representations. Thus there is no comparison to the great I Am. There is to be no redirected worship, like worshiping or standing in front of an icon, or kissing the statue, or kissing the feet of a statue, hauling a statue on your back, parading it down the street in some festival or some feast. Look at verse 7 of Exodus 20. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Even his name, there's to be no misuse of his name. We are not to treat the names of the Most High in a vain, empty, lewd, crass, useless, foolish manner. His name is off limits. As he says here in Exodus, I am jealous, verse 5. And then there's another place in the scriptures where we are told even his name is jealous. Thus, as we can plainly see so far this morning, God directs and dictates his worship of himself, and thus our own approach, get this, before him. Before him. Now, I'm not neglecting the fourth commandment about the Sabbath. I'm not neglecting that. There, God, not only does God dictate how we approach him, get this, he dictates when and why we are to approach him. And that's found in the fourth commandment. I'm not touching that here this morning, not because it's not there, it's because I want to emphasize the first three commandments, God, the very person of God, who he is, and how we are not to take the true and living God and denigrate him. Like those in the land of Israel, the current occupants of the land, when you come to Deuteronomy 12, those occupants who were to be removed, they were not worshiping the true and living God. Their worship had become perverted. Additionally, the New Covenant has not erased or nullified these words, but has actually enhanced them. Versus doing away with approaching God, as is found in the first three commandments of the ten, look at John chapter 4. Notice how even Jesus, who is God, who is the great I Am, even he shows a transition. Now, what did we find so far in Deuteronomy 12? There's a transition in that verse 8. You can't get 8, 9, 10, 11. You can't get around that. Moses says, up until now, every man's been doing what was right in his own eyes, right? Now, there's a change coming. Because you're going to get into the land and you're no longer going to be doing another 40 years of wandering. You're going to be putting roots into the ground. You're going to throw stakes into the ground. We're going to divide up this land by lots to you 12 tribes. Are you following? There's a transition. Well, notice how Jesus informs the woman at the well that there was another transition occurring because he was now on the earth. Look at verse 19, John 4, 19. The woman saith unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. Our fathers tell us we go to church here. And ye say, you Jews say, that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Notice how she brings up where to go to church. We got our church. You got, you Jews, you have your own mountain. You have your own complex, and guess what the Samaritans did before Jesus came on the scene? On Mount Gerizim, they built their own temple. You had two competing mountains, two competing temples, two competing centers of worship. And the woman at the well was trying to peg one against the other. So what was Jesus' response to her? Jesus said unto her, Woman, believe me, now I want you to watch carefully. Believe me, the hour cometh. Now that's future tense. When ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Now that's implying a transition from an old economy to the new. Ye worship ye know not what. Now why would Jesus have to say that? Was that kind of him? Telling her, you and your people have not a clue what you're doing? That's what he's saying. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. Now watch this. But the hour cometh, future, underline, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father, not on a designated mountaintop, but in spirit and truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship God must worship God in spirit and in truth. Look at that verse 23. Most Christians read that and don't even catch what's being said. Ma'am, lady, the hour is coming. Oh, by the way, now is. So even there, Jesus is giving a hint that the temple complex worship, and this is going to upset my premillennial dispensational friends, Jesus was already implying that there was a change coming, even in the temple complex worship. That grand, beautiful building, which he tells his disciples in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21 or Luke 22, this building is coming down. Not one stone shall be left upon another. True or false? He's already telling this woman, there's a transition coming, baby. Where no longer, you will no longer need to go to Mount Gerizim, and you don't need to take a holy pilgrimage to Jerusalem to worship the Father. Because Jesus now is saying, based on verses 23 and 24, since God is a spirit, you're not bound by a geographical location. You're not bound by a certain mountaintop. You're not bound by a certain high place. You can worship God in the very temple of your heart. Now, that doesn't take away the fact that we are to worship as a community. But beloved, Jesus is telling this woman there's a massive transition occurring. So guess what you have discovered this morning, hopefully. Deuteronomy 12, God was telling Moses to tell the people, transition time. Here, Jesus is telling the women at the well, transition time again. Both the Jews and the Samaritans in Jesus' day had boiled down their own respective worship to two separate geographical locations, to which neither one would bow out to. But what Jesus says in verses 21 to 24, especially verse 23, the hour cometh, future, and now is present tense reality, when the true worshipers of God shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. Now, beloved, did you catch what Jesus says here in verses, 23? True worshipers? You know what true worshipers imply? That there are true believers and there are phony believers. We've heard a pastor years ago, matter of fact, some 12 years ago, get really upset when I made reference in my preaching to true believers. He didn't like hearing that. Well, there's only one kind of Bible believer, and that's a true one, a gospel one, one who's been truly born again. Jesus makes the designator, not me, the true worshipers. He has the adjective in front of the word worshipers. He could have left it out. He could have chose not to use it, but he did use it. True worshipers, those that were in the land when Moses, when the people were about to cross over the Jordan, they were not worshiping God in spirit, let alone based by truth. They were worshiping gods that never existed in a religion that had twisted the truth, Romans 1. They took the truth and they twisted it and they fabricated a lie about the true and worship God. When it says spirit, I think that's referring to the heart, not based on a geographical location. When God says we are to worship him based in spirit and truth, by truth, I think that refers to God's words. Get this, his directives, his dictates, the way he calls the shots, not us calling the shots. That's what we see being communicated in Deuteronomy 12, 1 to 12. God to Moses to the people. Once they entered the land, a clean sweep of all the foreign gods, all the man-centered worship was to be done. It was to be eradicated, lest the people be tempted, listen carefully, to use, to borrow, or to incorporate the worship of God. What a man-centered worship. And unfortunately, what did Israel do? What did the Israelites do? They eventually did incorporate the worship of the pagans that were around them. And so, beloved, I want to leave off here because of time. But can I at least have stimulated your curiosity and at least your desire to say, that makes sense. A transition was about to occur. Once they got in the land, they were no longer to be roaming around, worshiping God in a tent. Once they got into the land, which it seems on God's part was a done deal. Matter of fact, you're going to go in and possess it, which they did. Then God will put his finger and designate a location. And there you would worship. Now Jesus comes on the scene in John 4 and says, guess what, lady? There's another transition. The worship of God will no longer be dictated to one lone geographical spot on any mountain or on any parcel of ground, but will be in the hearts of men, guided and directed by truth. Well, may God so be pleased to bless his word. Amen.